And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Dogmatic Slumbers. Should I use your real name, or should I address Mr. Slumbers? Or
no, you can call me Matt. I'm Matter generally on Twitter and things like that.
So okay, that's easier. Okay, thank you. Now, this is your first time on Millennial. This is another debut, so thank you. And also, thank you for rescheduling to accommodate other people today. So that was very helpful. Now, please introduce yourself first, and then we'll talk about your Substack.
Yeah, as I said, my name's Matt. I've been following these spheres for quite some time, but only like writing and creating stuff for, well, probably nearly about 2 years now, when I didn't really have a chance to before, but I was keen to get involved. Thanks very much for having me. And I think one of the great things about Millennial is the range of voices and the range of, you know, established people and people who, like myself, are newer to sort of being active in the scene. And I think one of the challenges, I guess, for those of us who are coming to it sort of a bit later, you know, in terms of creating any content or writing anything, is establishing. So it's really helpful actually to be here on the stream. I'm very pleased that you're here. Some people may have come across me. I have been talking about some of the sort of geopolitics with Semir Gog on his channel, and I have also been on Academic Agent's channel a while ago talking about Mr. Dominic Cummings. So you may have come across me there. My Substack is my main thing that I do. I tend to do sort of fairly deep dives into bits of geopolitics or politics or history, but I try to make them not just abstract, but relevant to some of the stuff that actually is going on in the world today. Hopefully the sort of things we'll talk about will demonstrate that.
Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words about Millennial, and you're welcome, and I was glad to invite you on. The Substack, would you like to speak generally about your Substack, when you started it, before we get into specific topics?
As I said, it's really about 2 years ago that I started it up in earnest. I had done a few small things beforehand. As I said, I have been like an observer of the scene for a long time, but I wasn't even on Twitter or X as it is now until the COVID year started up. So my Substack is, I tend to write about politics, geopolitics. I try to get a little bit of sort of arts and culture scene in as well. I want to do some more of that coming up. But it's just generally tends to be deep dives. And I do some book reviews of things as well. Some of my book reviews have gone out on. If any of your listeners have come across it, a little fairly new startup website called Decadent Serpent that is interesting in the sort of the scene or whatever you might call it. So yeah, that's about that really.
Right, okay. And first we're going to talk about Pakistan, and I guess we could talk first about the creation of Pakistan. So you say that was basically intended by the British as a way for them to retain a presence in the subcontinent. Could you go into that? Because we're obviously talking about the breakup of India. When was that? Was that the late 40s? I can't remember now. Is that late 40s or early 50s?
1947, yeah.
Right.
So one of the reasons I've been like diving into this year is obviously one of the big stories of the year has been the emergence into popular discourse and indeed politics, very generally, of the horrors of the rape gangs. So I started like really trying to get to the bottom of what was behind the arrival of lots of Pakistanis here, and as part of that went back to really try to uncover some of the untold stories about just what was sort of geopolitically behind the creation of Pakistan. There's a fairly like well-worn narrative that has been sort of evolving over the years, you know, from the creation in 47 onwards. But I was put onto a very, very interesting book by a source that, actually an Indian source, it was a guy called Sadila, who was actually an aide-de-camp to Mountbatten in 1947. And subsequent to that, he was a diplomat for India. I think he got as high as he was ambassador to France and so on. And after he retired, he went back doing lots of research about the untold story, you know, from the sort of early 40s onwards throughout the war until the actual sort of partition in 1947 itself. And it's a book that is available. It was published in India, but it was almost totally ignored in the UK. And actually, I would say, I would go as far as to say suppressed in the UK. So it really does go into, you know, so some absolutely fascinating details about what was actually behind it. To give a very brief summary,
before you do that, please outline the normal historiography here about why India was broken up.
Well, the sort of standard version has been that it's pretty much all down to Mountbatten and the Attlee government rushing it through. So obviously, you know, Attlee after and in 1945. Won the general election, and the Labour Party policy was much more pro-independence for India generally. Everyone at that stage was, certainly the stated options were to keep India together, as in sort of what is now India and Pakistan and indeed Bangladesh together as a unified entity. And that the... To put it, you know, relatively quickly, as far as this goes, the sort of standard narrative that was running really since 1947 was that it was largely down to Mountbatten, who had rushed it, and you know, partition was brutal. Massive relocations of people, hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of deaths as a result of it. But it sort of suited everyone from 47 onwards to pretend that in a sense it was much more the sort of policies of the leaders of India and Pakistan Nehru and Jinnah. And Mountbatten was sort of largely responsible for rushing it and leaving, you know, bringing the timetable forward and leaving rapidly. What actually Sarila talks about is that if he goes back through documents, Mountbatten, just to sorry, I should have said, was the last viceroy of India. He was appointed in 1946. But this book goes into a lot of detail about the two viceroys who preceded Mountbatten. And the key one for this is the one who was directly there before, who was a guy called Wavell, who again was an army officer. And it transpires that virtually all of the sort of, quotes, rushed Mountbatten plan was already planned for by Wavell beforehand. And he goes back into the sort of history of the files, and broadly, the logic for keeping Pakistan was, or keeping a British presence in India, which became Pakistan, was there from the start. Initially, it was to maintain shipping and trading routes with our interests in the Gulf. But as the war went on and tensions with the Soviet Union increased, imperative to an Indian, an independent India to border the strategic area with the USSR became an absolute driving force. It goes down as far as the actual lines on the map that were drawn were criticized a lot afterwards by, because a British civil servant was sent over to negotiate it, but actually the sort of rushed drawings of the lines on the map by this guy was almost exactly, with one or two small exceptions, the plan that Wavell had put in place beforehand. That's one side of it. So the logic for keeping a British presence was established, and the dealings that then went on after that broad thing was current under Mountbatten was absolutely. Pakistan as is was, it's clearly the sort of Muslim majority northwest India part. We subsequently had what is now Bangladesh as part of it as well, but it wasn't at all a unified whole. The actual key areas, as I said, the British were interested in keeping independent of Pakistan that they had impetus over, but the sort of border areas are like two parts of it. One was what is known as the Northwest Frontier Province, who were actually not keen on joining Pakistan as an independence at all, partially because they're ethnically different, partially because they're just they were suspicious that Jinnah was essentially working for the British. They were right in that. There was this area, and then there's the one of the parts of what is now like Jammu, what is now Jammu and Kashmir, which has been the source of tension between India and Pakistan ever since. The northernmost areas of that also were sort of bordering Afghanistan and China. And I'll deal with the latter first because it's really interesting. The sort of military presence on the ground there was run by two British officers. But British officers were like presence ground, and they basically just when Kashmir itself declared itself for India, not Pakistan, they just marched into the residency, took over, said we're joining Pakistan now, and literally just cooed it into Pakistan. The other area, the sort of Northwest Frontier Province, was put to a plebiscite referendum about whether it should join India or Pakistan. Essentially it was agreed that the pro-India, the Congress Party, would like to stand down from this. And so it was carried, but if it had been contested, it would have been very close. And Sarala goes into great detail about how, basically the British were behind both. to force a Pakistan that was a coherent entity that they could then keep control of. Subsequent to that, you know, once independence has happened as well, India and Pakistan immediately went to war over Kashmir. And after that, the sort of interest of Britain was to maintain Pakistan, but not make it overly strong, because they wanted to India to be, you know, basically India had to have some sort of positives out of this. And so once the war had started up, there were two occasions on which the Indian forces kind of advanced into, and this is where it gets current, the area of what is now Azad Kashmir and Mirpur, where, like, quotes, our Pakistanis come from now. And on two occasions, the Indian forces, who are commanded by a British officer who'd stayed on, liaised with the Pakistani forces, who were commanded by a British officer who had stayed on, in the first instance, the Indian, quotes, Indian head of the army informed the Pakistani head of the army, who were both British, that, you know, what sort of defensive positions they should take up against the invading Indian armies. And on the second occasion, the Indian, same guy, the general in charge, ordered a halt to Indian air superiority, so the Pakistani forces could maintain their positions. There's some amazing detail in this about the sort of geopolitical skullduggery that went on behind that to establish and maintain Pakistan. And it actually comes down to this day, because the areas that the Pakistani army kept by force from what was Kashmir, that's still the contested area between the two countries. That's where our seed population comes from.
Right. So the original rationale was to maintain a British presence, mostly to protect trade routes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was certainly the initial drive. British imperial possessions, although the actual nature of them were quite different, were, you know, based in the Gulf at the time, were incredibly important. 50% of our oil at that stage came from the Gulf. We obviously had interests in Iraq at that stage as well, although obviously Iran wasn't part of the empire then. What is now BP, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, was another major source. And the states of the Gulf that we now think of as some of the major oil and gas exporters, like Dubai in the UAE, Bahrain and Qatar, were in the early stages of really hitting commercial production of oil. A lot of it, as ever, was about protection of communications and the oil routes.
How did that evolve? I mean, I want to understand this as a narrative, as a story here. If it started with that, did it later become the case that the British decided, actually, we don't need a presence there at all, or what?
So at this stage, we're talking about during the war and up to independence in 1947, all of those states in the Gulf were still part of the empire in some way, apart from Iran, which we had basically during the war. We carved up Iran between the USSR and Britain into spheres of interest, where the USSR had a predominant position in the north of the country, and the British Empire had a predominant position in the south, and that's where all the oil is. So yes, essentially we had a predominance over all those oil and gas production facilities at the time. As I said, as the war went on and it became, obvious that tensions were going to happen with the USSR after the war ended. The strategic interests evolved from, not just protecting the oil, but to ensure that, broadly speaking, the USSR wouldn't invade south towards, the Indian Ocean and be able to threaten British interests there. So that was the sort of history of how the strategic interests of the empire moved.
And it was thought best to partition this along ethnic lines. So was there a clear ethnic genetic difference between the Muslims and the Hindus, other than their religion, obviously?
In the areas that we're talking about here, broadly, no. It is really a pure religious divide. I mean, clearly, India's a massive patchwork of different ethnicities, as well as different religions and different languages. But the areas in question were particularly in the Punjab, where really it's not that there isn't a sort of massive ethnic divide, and in Bengal the same thing would apply. So yeah, it really was partitioning along what you would say is the term they use was communal lines of managing communities through religions separately.
Right. Okay. And so at some point, was it decided that Britain didn't need to actually be in control of Pakistan?
There wasn't ever a plan to retain Pakistan, or at least there wasn't. There was a suggestion early on that we may retain one small piece of it, the province, as it were, bordering Iran, called Baluchistan, but that was abandoned fairly rapidly. There was a lot of pressure from the states throughout the war to basically decolonize. From an early stage, it was apparent that if there was going to be some sort of partition, then the independent Muslim areas that became Pakistan would be formally independent from Britain, as would the remainder of India, but that we would retain predominance in terms of security, in terms of advice, just in terms of influence after independence in Pakistan, and that's broadly what happened. After 1947, when both became independent, India went off on a much more sort of non-aligned course. So, during the 50s and 60s, it maintained good relations with the USSR. The USSR was its leading sort of arms supplier. It had a much more sort of socialized economy that was, not exactly sort of communist, but was more inspired by that sort of socialized model of development, whereas Pakistan, even though it became and still is sort of somewhat of an economic basket case, was notionally at least a freer and open economy, and subject to Western influence. As time went on, British influence did wane, and the US influence increased. such that sort of even up to sort of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, Pakistan was used as an outpost to spy on the Russian invasion and to coordinate the resistance to the sort of Soviet troops in Afghanistan. But Britain has always been equally involved, I would say, in Pakistan, but through informal ways.
Right, and so that probably brings us to the matter of the. Let me just get the name right. The Mangla Dam.
Mangla Dam. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this. Sorry.
Yeah, you might want to talk about the Mirpuris just to discuss, just to isolate what we mean when we say Mirpuri.
Yeah, so literally this is where I think it's the estimates are 70-odd% of the Pakistani population in Britain comes from this small area called Mirpur. This is in what they call Azad Kashmir. So this was the part that was retained by Pakistan militarily from Kashmir. One of the reasons that it was so strategic, and one of the reasons that, as I was talking about, the sort of military understanding between the British commanders of Indian and Pakistani forces in 1947, 1948, was that it's very strategic for control of water in Pakistan. Pakistan is dependent, always was and still is, probably sort of increasingly so, for irrigation for five rivers that form the Punjab. All of them go through Indian territory before they join the Indus. And broadly speaking, India has the ability to cut off the water or certainly interfere with it, simply cutting it off hard, but you can do things to muck it up and either flood or starve or just mess up the flows of water through the sort of Pakistani areas. They managed to sign under international pressure agreement, a treaty in 1960 between India and Pakistan to control or to agree how the water would be shared out between them. After that, as both India and Pakistan built dams, one of the largest, probably the second largest in Pakistan, is this dam called the Mangla Dam that was built from 63 to 67. And the as part of this, clearly building a huge great dam, a lot of sort of agricultural land was flooded. I think about 110,000 people had to be sort of relocated, and that's where Al Mirpur is come from. What is strange about it, and there's not much that's public about this, in fact, I'd say again, it's probably something that's been brushed under the carpet, is that they weren't relocated within Pakistan. They found their way to the, certainly the initial push that started the migrations into what were the northern mill towns in this country. And these are very, very majorly the populations behind the rape gangs that, have, I think we see reports yeah. now that actually started very early, but, have got, obviously, absolutely vast and terrible. Why they were relocated to the UK is an interesting question. After the Mangla Dam was finished, there was a further dam built later. I should say that the dam was built essentially by the British. It was all financed by the World Bank, as in, broadly speaking, the US, the UK, and Western powers. It was construction was obviously so important that when a brief war between Pakistan and India flared up in 1965, just broadly about 50 miles, I think, away from the dam construction. Dam construction went on. It was more important than war. When a subsequent dam was built that was actually slightly larger, but similar levels of people moved from their villages, they went inside Pakistan. So the question occurred to me, why did in one case Britain end up with the population of Mirpuris, and in the other case they were relocated internally? And this is where it gets really quite dark, which is that Mirpur itself, the actual centre, the actual town, was subject to one of the absolute worst instances of anything in partition. In one day in 1947, the Muslim Mirpuris slaughtered 20,000 people. That's
that's remarkable. That's like I can't remember how many died in the Somme in one day, but it's comparable.
Yeah, you're not the first person when I've given that number to make that analogy. It's absolutely correct. Along with that, there were mass abductions, mass rapes of Hindus, largely Hindus and some Sikhs. And so my working estimation is that because it was deemed by the British government and the West generally to be of such import to get this dam constructed and to, you know, maintain Pakistan, that we agreed to take a problem population off the hands of Pakistan. Now, I can't prove this, but there's... I can't see any other reason for why there's such a different treatment of different construction projects and what's happened. The narrative that, you know, at the time we needed workers for the mill towns just doesn't stack up, because at the time I think the mills of Lancashire were closing at the rate of one a week. So actually it was not that they needed to come over to work in the mills. It was the fact that the mill towns were emptying and it was somewhere that they could be put.
That's an astonishing idea, because it implies that the British government knew that this was a problem population and was perfectly willing to subject their own population to it.
It does, yes. It's not a pleasant thought, but...
No, it certainly isn't.
What happens.
Yeah. What would they have known in terms of it being a problem population? What would that actually mean? I mean, what would that mean? They do a lot of raping? They do a lot of child molestation? Or murder? Or what? I mean, from the British government's point of view, what would they know about this population?
Well, go back to the dates. So the actual sort of Mirpuri horrors were in 1947, and the dam was sort of constructed from 63 to 67. So we're talking about like 63, 64, 65 when things were starting up. So it was like less than a generation. So if you think of, you know, the average sort of families that were coming over, the strong likelihood is that a large number of the men would have been would have witnessed and taken part in some of those events in 47. Now there are wider cultural things generally. Mirpuris are looked down upon by the sort of other Pakistani communities, even in this country. You know, you can find like Pakistani dating sites on the internet where they'll flag no Mirpuris, please. So they are widely seen to be a rural and backward population, even by other like ethnic Muslims, ethnic Pakistanis and Muslims who live in this country.
Yeah. I've heard this, that the Mirpuris are despised in Pakistan itself. I don't know about in this country, but as you said, 70% of them in this country are Mirpuris.
Yep.
And so it's a low-grade population, you might say.
It is, and it's even the case that it's not particularly the case that Mirpuris have more, for instance, cousin marriage than other rural populations of Pakistan. It's not outlying, but they have very strong links. Clearly, what we're talking about in the 1960s was the seed population, but you know, we all know that cousin marriage and so on and bringing family relations over via marriage has been sort of pretty constant throughout after that. And indeed, even I think sometime in the early 2000s, there was the dam was raised of Mangalore, and a further like 20,000 or something Mirpuris is still in that sort of broad area were relocated. And you know, I just haven't found any, you know, there were like Pakistani politicians in this country, as it were, Muslims from that area, who you know, raised the subject. But again, it must have spurred a large amount of resettlement into this country, sort of even since then. I think it's a pretty grim story. It was virtually not discussed in Parliament at all when it was going on in the 1960s. There are one or two speeches that you can access on Hansard that refer to it and do actually refer to some of the horrors of you know, what went on, but you know, in a way of also wanting to cover them up. And yeah, so it's, as I say, that's my working hypothesis is that the reason that this population was brought here was that we agreed to take them.
It's remarkable. I wonder, I mean, you say it's just a few mentions of it in Hansard. So this would be something that went on either behind the back of Parliament or above Parliament.
Just outside of Parliament. I mean, I don't think it's terribly news that certainly major sort of geopolitical decisions aren't really discussed in Parliament. But you know, I think one of the things I'd like to point out is that the lack of debate, the lack of interest of politicians and say the state generally and the British people goes back an awful long way. And yeah, it's not a recent feature. It's been sort of baked in for an awfully long time.
Sorry, I was looking at the chat. It's remarkable, and again, you have this sense that decisions have been made at a very high level and not openly, and it took decades for the effects to become apparent. But now that they are apparent, and obviously, well, many would say, well, it's too late to do anything. This is a decision that you can't reverse. And you have the sense of the British, particularly, as a population that is abused by its own state, by its own government, and are even targeted for extinction by that.
That's right. It's It is just the case that for a long time the actual interests of the British people have been basically non-existent in state policy. Your point is very, very interesting about they have been here too long and there are too many for it. We just need to live with it. I think that's very relevant. I often make the analogy with immigration, and I think what all governments of both stripes, even though they're not, have attempted to manage is to make the old analogy with a bank, that if you owe the bank £1,000, it's your problem. If you owe them £1,000,000, it's their problem. Those numbers are probably a bit out of date given inflation.
Yeah.
I think one of the drivers with the speed of immigration and perhaps even up to and including the what we now call the Boris wave is to make immigration too big to fail.
Well, it is at this point where, for most of us, it's all that we've ever known. But still, it's also the case that in most parts of the country, in most towns, villages, just 10 years ago, we had a vastly different daily life. So it's I don't think it's irreversible. I don't think it's too late to reverse this, to a great extent. The question of remigration is perhaps outside the scope of this discussion. I don't know. I think it's another case where it has to get worse before it gets better, because the British public are certainly angry about immigration, but I don't know to what extent. I mean, and they clearly want mass deportations, but I think in their minds it's people who arrived here in the last 4 or 5 years. It's not people who've been here for 50 years. But I also think that the worse things get, the more they will actually want that. Because as we know, all of the child grooming, that's not people who arrived here in the last 5 years doing it. it might well be people who were even born here. I think I'm sure in a lot of cases it is. It's men who were born here. So this gets to various things that I've said on my Substack this year, that ultimately the only way to stop this predation on white girls by Pakistani men is for us to live separately, or to have some sort of police state, like 24/7 surveillance, or it's mass deportation of as many Pakistanis as possible.
Well, I think that's right, and the scale of the horrors and the scale of as we're talking about here, the Pakistani communities, I think does flip towards this logic of I think where I might want to raise a flag of this is that I think it's not something that the state would object to. I think the separation of people, I mean, clearly we know people sort anyway, but the scale of what we have now in terms of immigrant communities in this country, I think is providing its own sort of logic for what the only reasonable ways that a state can manage these levels is a very different one from the pretense of multiculturalism. Maybe it's time to bring out another of my ideas, which is the sort of militarization agenda, as I call it.
Please do that. Please introduce that.
Okay, so as I say, I think the scale of immigration in a society generally, I just think it has different levels of different levels, the way that a state, any state, you know, would manage that, are different, and they have their own internal logic. So, so at very low levels, you can have like the broad integration agenda, which is that, you know, if like some French Huguenots come over, you know, in a few generations, they're probably, you know, blend into the population. They're always going to be, you know, some people who, for whatever reason, arrive here, and you know, if they're, you know, some Pakistanis or whatever, at very low levels, they'll either go back or will, you know, basically keep very small communities. As the scale increases, I think what you get, what I call the sort of, you know, classic multiculturalism. I've called it Michaela multiculturalism before, after lovely Catherine Birbal Singh and her much lauded school, which is the sort of thing where people keep their own culture, but everyone makes sacrifices for the greater good. And this is, I think, very much what the state has been running at the moment, or up to this moment. But as the level increases, I think that no longer works either. And you know, every empire that's had, you know, substantially different populations manages them through what the term militarization comes from, the Ottoman Empire, where different religious communities, different ethnic communities, were managed under, you know, basically, the ruling elite had, you know, had ultimate authority. In this case, they're obviously Muslims, but the community then managed its own affairs pretty much separately, lived pretty much separately, kept a pretty much separate trades and industries, to the extent to which there was sort of almost like guilds who, you know, only the Jews would run banking, or the Armenians would run architecture, just pick a couple of examples. So I think we've got to the stage where we're undergoing a transition to that. And one thing that I think is quite interesting in this is that the position of the quotes conservative party, seem, and as conservative parties always tend to do, one of their like roles is to, as it were, quotes, conserve the previous orthodoxy. So for an awfully long time, we heard conservatives talking about integration and how integration wasn't, you know, people needed to integrate better and so on. And I think they're now sort of pretty much abandoning that. And this is why I use the Michaela example, is that Catherine Birbal Singh and her, you know, separate communities who all make sacrifices such that, you know, they don't eat meat because people, you know, won't eat, you know, obviously the Hindus won't eat beef, and the Muslims won't eat pork, and so on. This has been absolutely beloved of the conservative establishment. She's a real conservative establishment figure. She was clearly, you know, promoted by Michael Gove from the start with his program for academies and things like this, and I think this is a sign. I think, you know, almost they're stopping talking about integration as a model when they're talking about multiculturalism, which I take as a sign that the actual advance is moving more towards something like a more separate system. Now I think we're in the early phases of that, and what the hell it looks like for, you know, the white British population is I think unsure. I don't think we've had a situation where, you know, as it were, a majority population, as we still are, are forced to submit to, you know, some level of separation from it. So I'm not saying I know what's going to happen, and I think a lot's unclear. But I think the only way for a state to manage it is to undertake more formal measures over time, with the separation of communities. And yeah, so I think that's broadly what I predict will happen.
So just to be clear, you're saying, you're predicting that the British state will begin to allow and even manage segregation. It probably won't call it that, of course, but it will be a set of communities living alongside each other, but not really interacting with each other. Be separate, almost mini states.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, what are the some areas that you might see that? I mean, I don't think we're not going to be talking about, you know, sort of massive separate, you know, communities where you know, in one town, you know, the Muslims live, and the town 5 miles down the road, the white British live. I don't think it ever works like that. But I think we might well start to see, we are seeing, increased separateness in schooling. And one thing to bear in mind in this is that probably uniquely the British state has, you know, within our lifetimes, direct hands-on experiences of managing this, not always very successfully, but in Northern Ireland, where, you know, you get separate schooling, you get, you know, it's essentially outsourced policing, where you know, the sort of idea of policing by consent involves, you know, policing, you know, the police only sort of have access to and go into to certain areas with the consent of community leaders, or at least, you know, whilst the state obviously will always retain, you know, the right and the ability to do it, you know, that the actual way of working it in practice on a day-to-day basis involves a much different sort of level of interaction than I think we're used to on, you know, the mainland here.
Yeah. It's interesting because I heard that in Scotland they were building, this is, I guess, in the 60s, they were building a new town. I've forgotten what it was called now, but it was outside of Glasgow, and it was what an overspill town. It was, I guess there were slum clearances in Glasgow, and they were building this new town and funneling people to there. And this was going to be a mixture of Catholics and Protestants. And of course, they would naturally self-segregate. That's what, that would be their choice, most people. But the state deliberately mixed them up and had a Catholic family in one house, and right next door would be a Protestant family, and then the next house would be a Catholic family, and so forth, as much as was possible, because they wanted to eliminate that divide in society, what they would call a sectarian divide, which, let's be honest, is ugly a lot of the time, but when they clash. I guess the state was thinking in terms of moving beyond such primitive divisions and building a state, a new country, a new society in which people don't care about this stuff anymore, because they grew up alongside each other. They grew up with people of a different religion, and so they can live peacefully together. And but in the first instance, you've got to force them to live together. And then their kids will grow up with that as a norm, as a given. And what you seem to be saying, and I'm like, as I say, that must have been the 60s, maybe the 70s, I don't know. And what you seem to be saying is that the British state is beginning to embrace the very opposite of that. Like, that it's realised that, and of course we don't even need to talk about all the multicultural efforts and propaganda conditioning and TV and so on to promote that, and of course not just culture but race, for years, or all of my life, probably all of your life, the ideal presented in the British media has been a community of all different types of people, and they all get along, they all eat fish and chips, and other than that they go and do their own thing, and nobody's bothered by that. What you seem to be saying is that 50 years on, the British state has realised that this actually is just not tenable. And you need to allow people, in fact, you need to facilitate people living separately. Maybe even force them to.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're probably quite a long way from that, and I think the British state isn't probably particularly good at using force in that sort of way. How actually this will work in practice is going to be very unclear. I think one thing that, you know, we're clearly not going to have is like a ruling elite, you know, that you might say that have the most visible element, the political class, from just one sector, one community, as everyone says these days. I think that they will maintain the illusion or the pretense that, you know, that which is actually probably real in a certain sense, that, you know, whilst we're still sort of going along this agenda, that if you rise above, you know, into the elite circles, it will be, you know, a liberal ideal that anyone can, you know, can be there, that, you know, all races are represented. You know, I think we see this with the Home Secretary at the moment, who actually is a Mirpuri, Shabana Mahmood. But yeah, the actual day to day how things are managed on the ground will, yeah, I think begin to fracture more. And of course, one of the ways that actually this, I think, will be sold to the white British population is by things like, you know, well, we do need to be protected from things like the rape gangs, and, you know, to have like more coherent communities that where the interactions are not reduced to zero, but where, you know, communities can actually look out for, you know, vulnerable people. Maybe, I mean, I'm just floating ideas here, but they may be used to sell the benefits to the British people that, you know, you need to protect yourselves. It's probably also quite interesting in this context that one of the other big narratives that we've had this year is the sort of civil war is coming narrative from the sort of likes of David Betts that's been quite largely picked up by,
yes,
a hell of a lot of people. Now I don't know if we want to get into that too much, but I just, you know, there is no way civil war is coming broadly, but clearly the government does want there to be this narrative out there that's being discussed, to give like the prospect that different communities might live more separately in the future.
So you think that David Betts is operating on behalf of the British government?
Oh, I think he's certainly very well connected in security terms. I mean, I'll direct people to a Strump and Evelyn's recent stream on him. He's a professor of war studies at King's College London. King's College London is absolutely regime central. And he has a background of advising government on counterinsurgency. He's, you know, I think it most unlikely that he's a professor who's gone rogue. I think he's, as we see with other figures, is running a narrative that the state wants to run. Just as one example, I mean, he talks quite openly about rape gangs, and there aren't many college university professors who could get away with. You know, being brutally honest as he is about the horrors of rape gangs, and for him not to have massive amounts of student protests, it's unlikely.
So, yeah, okay. I haven't seen Scrump and Evelyn's stream about this yet because I've been so busy with Millennial. It seems plausible to me that David Betts is honest, that he's been studying conflict for many years, and I'm not saying that this is the case, I'm just speculating that he's been studying conflict for many years, and He sees that his own country is heading towards something in his mind, and he's one of the first academics to speak out about it, because if that were happening, then there would be some academics who broke away from the multi-culti consensus first before everyone else did. So I don't know how. Oh, what would you say about that? I think for most people, the evidence in the case of David Betts is his background, his being involved with the British state before now.
Yeah, that's true. But I see no evidence that he's still not involved with the British state. As I say, it's also the case that I would expect if any other professor had taken the lines that he had, that there'd be some backlash against him, and there just doesn't seem to be. You know, he seems to be, you know, able to talk to, you know, quotes, the right, without receiving the ire of the left. And academia is not somewhere where people are able to speak freely about anything that's sort of broadly on the right, let alone something as controversial as, well, not controversial, but controversial to the left and the establishment as the right gangs.
Yeah, that's true. I haven't seen many people castigating him, demonizing him. And yeah, that is surprising. But then the explanation that he's been given permission by the British state to do this doesn't really make sense, because how do these other academics know that? How do they all know, oh, we've got to leave him alone, he's operating, he's got a special permission slip?
Well, I don't think it's as much as a special permission slip. I mean, and it's certainly the case that he has been involved with the state and has literally advised on counterinsurgency measures in the past, and it is, you know, it doesn't really matter whether I'm not saying he's been primed to do a job by the state, or he may be, but his position suits what sort of conversations want to be allowed out into the wider sphere, in my view.
Yeah. So you think that we're very much moving away from the consensus that multiculti and race mixing. Well, what do you think about that? Okay, because those are actually two different things. And it seems to me that multiculturalism was always a sort of stepping stone to pushing race mixing. That what the state ultimately wanted was for everyone to just mix together in every way. So would you say that that is still desired as an end goal, or have they completely given up on that?
I think I'm not sure to the extent to which, if it was an end goal, I think it's probably become quite apparent that, you know, the sort of representation and adverts and so on is, you know, just bears no relation to what people actually want to do in their, you know, in their real lives and their relationships. It may be that they've given up the pretense that you know, people have started observing those images of not exactly multiculturalism but mixing just doesn't happen in real life, and that, yeah, there's some withdrawal from that. I do think that's probably likely. And as I say, as far as the multicultural aspect of it goes, I think we're still running that as a narrative, and I think we still will. You know, the official narrative will still be about the benefits of, you know, diversity and different societies and you know, wonderful food and everything like that. Whilst the sort of underlying mechanics move towards more separation of different races, different communities, different religions.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Well, there's actually a super chat here that's perhaps quite relevant to this. Please ask Dogmatic Slumbers his thoughts on the prospect of a reformed government and the contested claims to conservatism between Badenoch and Farage. That's I think I would ask that question to you broadly with special regard to what we've been talking about. Badenoch and Farage, I mean, one of them is a white English guy, I believe of Huguenot ancestry, which is probably minimal at this point. And the other is, I think she's Nigerian. Self-explanatory. And one of them, well, these two parties seem to be now jockeying to appear more hardcore about mass deportations. So what do you think about that contest?
Yeah, as I said earlier on, getting back to as you asked, one of the points of the conservative side of the argument is I think to maintain the previous illusions. So, although you know the questions, and as it's a good question by the super chatter was about the leaders, I think it's a bit I think it's interesting to look at the top teams of both. So in one, the Conservatives, you have Badenoch as the leader, but the people really making the sort of running on things are really comes down to, I would point out, Robert Jenrick and Katie Lamb. Interesting backgrounds of both of those ethnically, and in Reform, obviously, you've got what's his name, Zia Yusuf, as obviously not an MP, but as the sort of leading light behind the sort of organisation of the party, and trying to professionalise it because he's meant to be a successful businessman and so on. So both sort of have that same element. Now, I think it's right I think the rhetoric of the Conservatives certainly seems to be wider and more sort of I might say right wing than Reform a lot of the time. I think it's easy for them to do that because in a sense their brand became so bad that they can say anything they like now, and in a sense, who will believe them? But I do sort of see it in both, and there is some jockeying for position in that. But I don't really see that. I don't really see much difference between them in rhetoric, to be honest, at the moment. And it's sort of whatever happens, with the sort of party political right in the next few years, and it's looking as if Reform are going to do quite a job of squeezing the Conservatives. It makes sense for the Conservatives to be more extreme on rhetoric about more deportations. I don't think it makes any sense that it won't necessarily be what will happen, but it makes sense for them to talk about it. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the public trust the Conservatives anyway, so it doesn't really matter what they say. I don't think they're going to get in, and I agree with you that. Actually, did you say that for Trump Reform are going to get in at the next election? Keith Wood said that in the previous stream. Maybe I'm losing the plot. On Present Trends, would you suppose that Reform are going to form the next government, or is it too early to say?
I think it's too early to say. Actually, I think the sort of constant polling that we get at the moment is itself like a political technique of the ruling the political classes to keep everyone focused and concentrating on the moment. They might well get in, but what will be interesting is how the, less the forces on the right, I think, in a way, but it's how the evolution of the parties of the left, assuming there's any difference between these, really, go. You know, whether the Greens do continue their momentum, and almost whether, you know, Labour will do a deal with the Liberal Democrats to not contest things. I think there's an awful lot that can happen that would mean that. Yeah, we're certainly not guaranteed a reform government at the moment, I think.
Right, okay. But from what you've said before now, it seems that you don't really think this matters anyway, because the British state is manoeuvring and the political parties, all of the general elections and the democracy is just a front. And the British state is taking action anyway.
Well, I don't believe that, certainly under conditions that we have at the moment, that you know, there is like a political solution. I think it would take a large change for there to be sort of anything that's reflected in, you know, politics at Westminster that will be more to our advantage. And it's pretty clear to I think reform are. Not a solution. It may be, you know, better for a time. It's sort of the argument that people have with Trump in the US. It's, you know, it may be better for a time to have it, but it's not. I think a fundamental solution to things. You know, Nigel Farage will not be undertaking mass deportations.
Sorry, go on.
I would just say, as far as, you know, the sort of. Might call the whether it matters at all. Well, you know, there is a cost in managing a population, and the in a sense it's like an effort against gravity, isn't it? So on something like COVID, you know, they could manage to you know, keep up you know, the COVID regime for a number of years. But, it, you know, the state can do things when it really wants to. But I think they also have to bear in the costs of compliance. And the more difficult the project is, the longer it goes on, the higher the sort of costs of compliance. I don't mean costs in terms of financial costs. I mean just costs in terms of reputation and you know, keeping the population inside, as it was COVID, actually sort of, you know, pretty much locking us up in our houses, or attempting to at least. I think it's a bit different when it comes to geopolitical matters, because, you know, people, the majority of the population don't really have much of an interest in it. It's not, you know, there are broad things that are discussed, you know, in terms of, you know, for example, the war in Ukraine, but it's pretty easy, I think, for the state to manage matters of international relations and geopolitics, pretty much independent of the population. You know, certainly, not saying if it got to the stage of actually sort of going to war. I mean, clearly that's huge, but in normal times, I think the state just does what it wants in terms of geopolitics, and it doesn't really. You know, the interests of the British people, both in the short term sense of an interest in the topic, or the fundamental interests of the British people, for example, something like the relocation of the Mirpuris, I don't think doesn't matter to the state at all.
Right, and yet you think they want segregation, because, well, that would imply that the public mood does matter to them in some way.
Sorry, for the moment of doubt, that I was talking about the public mood in terms of international relations and geopolitics there. Clearly, stuff in people's lives, you know, whether they're getting mugged by populations or the sort of deteriorating situation that we see in terms of everything, you know, from the sort of law and order on the streets to the, you know, see the rape gangs does matter very much to people. Yeah, so I'm sorry that wasn't clear.
Yeah, yeah. I should have followed your train of thought better. Okay, well, I think this has been a very interesting and thought-provoking discussion, so thank you. There are two super chats. One of them is from Dawn, and she says, thanks, chaps, thank you. And the other one is from Stephen, and he says, it could be the case that the King's College professor, David Betts, isn't lambasted by other academics, because he does have a permission slip with BBC et al. And other media, and the other academics don't want to be seen going against one who's not already an enemy of the regime platforms. Well, yeah, but except that I haven't seen him on the BBC. As far as I know, his exposure has really been online. I've forgotten what it called. That woman's name is.
He started off
from podcasts.
Yeah, he's very much been in the podcast sphere, which is, I think, a sign that the audience that he's trying to talk to or being presented to talk to is, you know, the sort of people who watch those podcasts, which is, I think, the, you know, pretty much the sort of engaged online right more than mass population as a whole. Louise Perry, is it? I think he was.
That's it. That's the one. That's the one. You might be right. I really don't know. I really don't know about David Betts. People are very adamant on either side, and as I said, I could imagine him just being the first of an avalanche, or I could imagine him being a state asset, an agent of the state. So at this point, I don't know. Although I do think, frankly, that his whole thing would be more plausible if he didn't say civil war, if he just said civil unrest. He keeps using the term civil war, and I don't think that's going to happen. But anyway, okay. Well, let's leave it there. This has been an interesting chat, so thank you, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in 25 minutes with the final interview for tonight, but in the meantime, Matt, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It's been good fun. Thanks, excellent. Everyone.
Okay, thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.